Good evening. So, as Dorley said, the plan tonight is to do a shared group reading of chapter 4 of the Lotus Sutra. And this chapter is interesting. When I planned to do this, or when I came up with the idea of doing this, I didn't realize that it would be the day after Father's Day. But it is the day after Father's Day and day after the summer solstice. And interestingly enough, the story of this chapter of the Lotus Sutra is about the estrangement of a father and a son and their reconciliation and their finding each other. So that was an interesting coincidence. And then another interesting coincidence was that yesterday, as I sometimes do in the morning, no, this was on Saturday night, yesterday, I tuned in to the Hartford Street Zen Center, where they have a Saturday public program, thinking I would hear Reverend Mio's Dharma talk, abbot of the Hartford Street Zen Center, who frequently lectures there. But once in a while, they had have a guest speaker, and as it turned out, Saturday there was a guest speaker, and the guest speaker was a Nichiren priest. And if you know about that sect of Buddhism, they revere and uphold and study and chant the Lotus Sutra as their main practice. And this guy's name was Michael something. I never did get his last name, but he was, of course, talking about his practice and his practice and the shared practice of the Nichiren school. Main practice is to chant the Dai Moku, which is the title of the Lotus Sutra in Japanese. So it Myoho Renge Kyo. Myoho Renge Kyo is the title of the Lotus Sutra in Japanese, and it means homage to the wondrous Dharma of the Lotus Sutra, or the wondrous law, but that's Dharma, right? So the wondrous law of the Lotus Sutra. But he was a Nichiren priest, but conversant in Zen, since he was invited into a Zen temple. The topic that he took for his Dharma talk was a fascicle about the Lotus Sutra by Dogen. And that fascicle is called Hoke Tenhoke, or the Dharma flower, that is the lotus flower. The Dharma flower turns the Dharma flower. So that was quite a coincidence that I was going to be speaking about a chapter in the Lotus Sutra, and who do I come upon to hear but a big fan of the Lotus Sutra, a priest in the Nichiren school. And he reminded us that, of course, Dogen, our founder of our school in Japan, was initially ordained as a Tendai monk, which that school also takes as their main text the Lotus Sutra. So they're big fans of the Lotus Sutra too, and I believe Dogen was ordained at the age of 13, and that was the school that he was ordained in, and initially, before he, converted or went to practice at Kenenji in Kyoto with Isai, And then, of course, you know, really stayed on the Zen path for the rest of his life, but remained, you know, a big, you know, very reverent, with a great deal of reverence and homage to the Lotus Sutra throughout his life, and wrote about it. And of course, there's a story about him doing something like the end of his life. He put the Lotus Sutra, or some part of the Lotus Sutra, on a, or the, maybe he put the title of the Lotus Sutra on a pillar, and he circled that pillar. So he remained a fondness for the Lotus Sutra throughout his life, and a kind of reverence for it. And actually, this fellow kind of told us why, you know, or what was the main attraction, that Dogen had for the Lotus Sutra. What was the main attraction? And he pointed to the Skillful Means chapter of the Lotus Sutra, which is chapter 2. And I read that chapter, and I agreed with him. This is why Dogen really, really loved the Lotus Sutra. And so I'm going to read you a little bit from chapter 2 before we get into chapter 4, just so you have a feeling of why this sutra plays such a central role in Mahayana Buddhism, really, you know. These are the Buddha's words. What do I mean? I forget who he's talking to right here. Maybe Shariputra? I think Shariputra. What do I mean by saying it is for this one great cause alone that Buddhas, the world-honored ones, appear in the world? Why do Buddhas, what is the great cause that for Buddhas to appear in the world? The Buddhas, the world-honored ones, appear in the world because they want living beings to open a way to the Buddha's insight and thus become free of attachment. They appear in the world because they want to demonstrate the Buddha's insight to living beings. They appear in the world because they want living beings to apprehend things with the Buddha's insight. They appear in the world because they want living beings to enter into the way of the Buddha's insight. This alone is the one great cause, Shariputra, for which Buddhas appear in the world. So that, I don't know if you heard the verbs, but the verbs were, why do they appear? Why do these Buddhas appear? To open, to demonstrate, to apprehend, to cause living beings to open, to demonstrate to these living beings, to cause these living beings to apprehend and to enter, to open, to demonstrate, to apprehend, and to enter the Dharma. That's the reason these Buddhas appear in the world. And I think that's how we can understand Dogen's abiding love for the Lotus Sutra, because this is what, you know, he wanted for us. You know, he wanted for his disciples. He wanted them to open, apprehend, enter the Dharma. So that's a little bit of background, you know, kind of a place for you to understand. I have, years ago, I used to suggest in this sangha that we study the Lotus Sutra, and people were like, no, don't make us study the Lotus Sutra. But I just wanted to just give that little background to say, why would possibly, you know, Zen sangha or Zen people want to study the Lotus Sutra? And I think this is this is, you know, the key point. So one of the ancient practices for studying a sutra is to read the sutra out loud, you know, with a group. This is something that people have done for, you know, thousands of years, you know, to read a sutra out loud. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And we're going to read, I think there are, I want to say there's five parables in the Lotus Sutra. And this is one of, this is a parable. And one of the, it's very, probably maybe the most accessible parable in the whole of the Lotus Sutra. And it, I think this parable also asks the question, or asks of us, or suggests a question to us, is how do we come to have faith in the Dharma, and how do we enter the Buddha's way? I think that this parable is talking about that question, and it's a question, as we hear this, as we read this, we can keep in mind. How do we come to have faith in the Dharma, and how do we enter the Buddha way? And this parable is an example of how that happens for somebody, for this son that is in the story, for this son that's in the story. It's the answer to that. Or it shows it happening, how he comes to have faith and enter. So what I've done is I've put this I did a little kindergarten project where I Xerox the chapter, and I spent some time cutting it up into paragraphs. And I think there's 19 people here, and there's 17 cards. So if you have, there's some cards that have a longer bit of text on them. So maybe if you come, if one of those cards lands in your lap, you can share it with your neighbor. And if two people do that, like if just two people share their card, then everybody will get a chance to read. I'm sorry for the online people. I can't give you a card from here. So just enjoy the reading. It looks like number 9 is pretty long, so that person who gets that. And number 12 looks pretty long. So if you get that card, share it with your neighbor, and I think everybody will get a chance to read. So and each card is numbered, and I suggest that just so we... you know, we know what's happening, and we keep it the order going, that you read your number before you read your card, and then the person who has the number subsequent to you will know it's their turn to read, right? So I'm going to give the first card to Kristen, because I think she can pronounce some difficult names in here, because there's some Sanskrit names in here. And no pressure, but I think she's seen these names before. That's my guess. I didn't give her the card in advance, though, so I think she'll get it.
I did discuss it with her. So, and here's the trick. Sorry. Here's the trick, and the reason I did this...
And the reason I did this on the cards is that... you could hold the mic and, you know, in one hand and read the card, and you'd, you know, be able to do that. If you had a book, it would have been very hard. So that's why I did this. I was thinking of you people online, too. So that's what we'll do. And just read your number, and we'll go from there. And we'll read Faith and Understanding.
9. Share with your neighbor. Well, share that with your neighbor behind. What's that number? What number do you have? 14, 15.
16, 17. Okay. So, you'll have to pass the mic too, so. Whenever you're ready.
Faith and understanding, number one. At that time, four men living a life of wisdom, Subhuti, Mahakadhyayana, Mahakashapa, and Mahamaudgalyayana, hearing the Dharma they had never heard before from the Buddha, and the assurance by the world-honored one of Shariputra's future supreme awakening, were astonished and ecstatic with joy from experiencing such an unprecedented thing. They immediately rose from their seats, arranged their robes, bared their right shoulders, and knelt on their right knees on the ground. Putting their palms together in complete devotion, they bowed in respect, gazed up at his honored face, and said to the Buddha,
"Two. We leading monks, old and worn out, believed that we had already attained nirvana and could go no further. So we did not seek supreme awakening. The world-honored one has been preaching the Dharma for a long time, and all the while we have been sitting in our places, weary in body and mindful only of emptiness, formlessness, and non-action. Neither the enjoyments nor the divine powers of the Bodhisattva Dharma, purifying Buddha lands and saving living beings, appealed to us."
Three. Why was this? The world-honored one had made it possible for us to rise above the threefold world and gain evidence of nirvana. Besides, we are so old and worn out that when we heard of supreme awakening with which the Buddha teaches and transforms bodhisattvas, no thought of pursuing it was attractive to us. Now, hearing directly from the Buddha that shravakas are assured of attaining supreme awakening, we are very happy. We have gained something we never before experienced. Unexpectedly and suddenly, we have now heard this rare Dharma. We see ourselves as extremely fortunate. Without even seeking it, we have acquired something great and good, an extremely rare treasure.
For world-honored one, we would now like to use a parable to clarify what we mean. Suppose a still young man left his father, ran away, and lived in some other land for a long time, for 10, 20, or even 50 years. The older he became, the poorer and more needy he became. He wandered around in every direction, looking for clothing and food until, finally by chance, he was heading towards his homeland. Meanwhile, his father had searched for this son unsuccessfully and now lived in another city. His household had become very wealthy, his goods, his treasures, incalculable. Silver, gold, lapis, lazuli, coral, amber, crystal, and other gems overflowed his stone houses. He also had many grooms and servants, clerks and attendants, and countless elephants, horses, carriages, oxen, and sheep. His revenues and investments spread to other lands. There also were many merchants and traveling traders all around.
Five. At this time, the poor son, wandering through village after village, and passing through various lands and cities, at last reached the city where his father was living. Although his son had been away for more than 50 years, the father always thought about him. But he had never spoken of the matter to anyone, only pondering it to himself, his heart full of remorse and regret. He thought, "Old and worn out, I have great wealth. Gold, silver, and rare treasures overflow my storehouses. Yet I have no son. Someday my end will come, and my wealth will be scattered and lost, for there is no one to whom I can leave it." This is why he always so earnestly thought of his son. "If I could only get my son back and entrust my wealth to him," he thought, "how contented, how happy I would be with no more anxiety."
Six. Meanwhile, world-honored one, the poor son, drifting from one job to another, accidentally arrived at his father's house. Standing by the gate, he saw his father from a distance, seated on a lion seat. His feet were on a jeweled footstool, and strings of pearls worth tens of millions adorned his body. He was being revered by surrounding Brahmins, nobles, and ordinary people, while attendants and servants with white fly whisks stood by on both sides. Over him was a jeweled canopy from which streamers of flowers hung down. Perfume was sprinkled on the ground, and all kinds of celebrated flowers were scattered around, and valuable things were set in rows for his approval or rejection. With such trappings, he looked majestic and distinguished.
Seven. The poor son, seeing his father with such great power, was seized with fear and regretted that he had come to this place. He secretly thought to himself, "He must be a king or something like a king. This is no place for me to try to earn a living. I had better go to some poor town where I can be paid for my labor and where food and clothing will be easier to get. If I stay here long, I may be captured and forced to work." Having thoughts of this kind, he ran away quickly. Meanwhile, the elderly gentleman on the lion seat recognized his son at first sight. Filled with joy, he thought, "At last I have the one to whom my stores of wealth are to be entrusted. I've always been thinking of my son, but had no way to see him. Now suddenly he has come by himself. My hope is completely fulfilled. Old and worn out, I yearn for an heir."
Eight. Then he sent messengers to run after the son and bring him back as quickly as possible. They ran after him and grabbed him. The poor son, surprised and afraid, loudly cried out in anger, "I have done nothing against you. Why am I being seized?" The messengers held on to him even more firmly and forced him to go back with them. Then the poor son thought that, although he had done nothing wrong, he was being taken prisoner and surely would be put to death. All the more terrified and desperate, he fell down in a faint. The father, seeing this from a distance, told the messengers, "There is no need for this man. Don't force him to come. Sprinkle some cold water on his face to wake him up, and say nothing more to him."
Nine.
Why did he do this? The father knew that his son felt inept and humble, and that his own great position would be difficult for his son. He knew perfectly well that this was his son, but using skillful means, he didn't tell anyone that this was so. The messengers told the son, "We are releasing you now. You are free to go wherever you want." So the poor son rejoiced, having obtained what he had not had before. He got up from the ground and went off to a poor village in search of food and clothing.
Nine and a half. Then the rich man, wanting to entice his son back, decided to use skillful means again. Secretly, he sent two men, a miserable and undignified appearance, after him, saying, "Go there and visit, and gently tell the poor man that there is a place for him to work where he will be given double the normal wage. If he agrees, bring him back here and put him to work. If he asks what kind of work you want him to do, tell him that we are hiring him to remove dung, and that you will work along with him."
10. Then the two messengers went in search of the poor man, and finding him, told to him what they had been told to say. The poor son asked for an advance on his wages, and joined them in removing the dung. The father, seeing the son, felt both sympathy and wonder. On another day, looking through a window, he saw his son at a distance, looking gaunt, lean, and filthy from the piles of dung, dirt, and filth. Taking off his necklaces, his soft clothing, and ornaments, he put on coarse, torn, and dirty clothes, smeared his body with dirt, took a pan for dung in his right hand, and said in a rough manner to the workers, "Get to work, don't be so lazy." Through such skillful means, he could get near his son.
11. Afterward, he said to the son, "Young man, now you should stay and work here, not go anywhere else again. I will increase your wages, and you won't have to worry about needing bowls, utensils, rice, flour, salt, vinegar, and so on. There is even an old and worn-out servant you can use if you need him. Take it easy. I'm like a father to you. You don't need to worry anymore. Why? Because I am old and advanced in years, but you are young and vigorous. All the time you've been working here, you've never been deceitful, lazy, angry, or grumbling. I have never seen you display the faults of other workers. From now on, you will be like my own son." Then the rich man gave him a new name, as he would to a child.
12. Then the poor son, though pleased with all of this, still thought of himself as an humble laborer. Thus for 20 years he continued to be employed at removing dung. After that, they gained confidence in each other, and the son felt he could come and go easily. Yet he continued to live in the same place as before. "World-honored one," then the old man became ill. Knowing that he would die soon, he said to the poor son, "I now have abundant gold, silver, and rare treasures filling my storehouses to overflowing. I want you to have a detailed understanding of the quantities involved and of what should be received and paid out. This is what I have in mind and want you to do. Why? Because from now on, you and I will be no different. Be careful to see that there are no careless losses."
The poor son accepted these instructions and took stock of all the goods, gold, silver, and other valuables, and of the various storehouses, but never expected to receive even a meal for himself. He continued to live in the place where he had lived before and was unable to get rid of his sense of inferiority.
13. After some time had passed, the father saw that his son was gradually becoming more confident and accomplished, and that he despised his former state of inferiority. Realizing that his own end was near, he ordered his son to arrange a meeting with his relatives, the king, the ministers, nobles, and ordinary citizens. When they had all assembled, he said to them, "Gentlemen, I should tell you that this is my son, my natural-born son. In another city, he left me and ran away. For over 50 years enduring loneliness and suffering. His original name was so-and-so, and my name is so-and-so. At that time, when I was still living in my hometown, I worried about him and looked all over for him. It was here that I suddenly happened to meet him again. This is really my son, and I am really his father. Now that all of my wealth belongs entirely to my son, and all my earlier disbursements and receipts are known by my son. World-honored one, when the poor son heard these words of his father, having gained something he had never had before, he was filled with joy, and he thought, without any intention or effort on my part, these treasures have now come to me by themselves."
14. World-honored one, the very rich old man is the Tathagata, and we are all like the Buddha's children. The Tathagata has always taught that we are his children. Because of the three kinds of suffering, world-honored one, in the midst of birth and death, we have borne all kinds of passionate worries. Being confused and ignorant, we enjoy detachment to lesser teachings. Today, the world-honored one has led us to ponder over and to rid ourselves of such teachings and all the dung of diverting discussions. In the past, we were diligent and made progress in this way until we reached nirvana, which is like a single day's pay. Having attained this nirvana, our hearts were filled with great joy. We were content. We said to ourselves, due to our diligent perseverance in the Buddha Dharma, we have received many rewards.
15. However, the world-honored one, knowing from past experience that we were attached to low desires and delighted in lesser teachings, let us go our own way and did not tell us, "You will yet have the insight of a Tathagata, your portion of the treasury." Using the power of skillful means, the world-honored one taught Tathagata wisdom, but following the Buddha and attaining a single day's pay of nirvana seems such a great gain to us that we never devoted ourselves to seeking the great vehicle.
Also, since we revealed and preached Tathagata wisdom for the sake of bodhisattvas, we never aspired it to ourselves, Why was this? The Buddha, knowing that we delighted in lesser teachings, used his power of skillful means to teach us according to what was appropriate for us. But still, we did not see that we are really children of the Buddha. But now we know. We realize that the world-honored one does not hold back the wisdom of the Buddha from anyone. Why do we say this? From ancient times, we were really children of the Buddha, but only took pleasure in lesser teachings. If we had had a mind to take pleasure in great things, the Buddha would have taught the great vehicle Dharma for our sakes.
17. Now in this sutra, the Buddha teaches only the one vehicle. Although in the past he spoke disparagingly in the presence of bodhisattvas, the shravakas' liking for lesser teachings, in reality he was using the great vehicle to teach and transform us. Therefore, we say that, though we had no hope or expectation of it, now the great treasure of the King of the Dharma has come to us by itself. Since it is something that the children of the Buddha should acquire, we all have acquired it.